Nighttime on Still Waters. This is NB506812, narrowcasting into the night from somewhere on Britain's waterways.
Eighth of May, Wednesday. A May evening of golden haze and drifting willow down, and the busy day winds down. Nearby, lambs call as mothers graze and nuzzle. Beyond them, chiff-chaff, robin, and blue-tit. Further distant, the sound of children playing. Beyond that, a dog barks, and another answers. Further still, a train clatters over some points. Encircled by ever-increasing concentric rings of soundscapes that pin me to the epicenter of this May evening of golden haze. The moon is still young, a sickle of quicksilver dipping low in the west. And there's a ragged wind blowing in from the east, warm and dusty, gusting and hooliganing around the alders, beveling the surface of the canal. And there's a change in the air, the static charge of expectation. The hot, dry spell is ending. Even now, storms are rolling in towards us over the Atlantic. This is the Narrowboat Erica, narrowcasting into the darkness of a May night under a perfect crescent moon, to you, wherever you are. Thank you so much for coming. I was hoping you could make it tonight. It's been a long and busy week, so come inside for a while. Put your feet up, the kettle is on, the biscuit barrel is to hand, and welcome aboard. The last few days have rolled in warm and sunny, catching a few by surprise. Sweating in jumpers ill-chosen in the damp, cool breath of dawn, hurriedly damping down stoves and opening windows. Apparently around here there was a frost last weekend. And there's certainly been a touch of summer heat about things here. There's the hay-sweet, cattle-byer smell of cut grass, warmed by the sun. The slowing of the pace along the canal banks. But it's not summer, not yet. Breathe in deeply and you can taste with your nose the bouquet of hawthorn and cow parsley and fresh growth of nettle. The towpaths swell with an aromatic palate, rich and fertile with colour and as heady as any wine. The wine of high spring. And it's all come rather suddenly. Nature's Calendar, a book based on the 72 microseasons of Japan, declare this week to be first swifts, leading into the second week, lilac time. They're well named. Last week I spotted our first pair of swallows, a rush of arrow flight, black and white and a soft blur of dull red, needling over the hill and down toward the open stretch of the canal, where there's plenty of insects for them to eat after their long journey. Soft, muzzy veils hang and dance over the canal's surface, chaotic murmurations shoaling in lazy air of tiny dragons on breath-thin wings. The fish, too, appreciate these aerial contortions. The mirrored water breaking in splashes that sends rings across the canal and into the thick new stands of reeds where the moorhens hide. Spring is suddenly here, and she's in full stride, and summer will need to run quick to catch up. And in fact, for me this year, she's too fast for me to keep up with. Purples and blues of vetch, forget-me-not, have taken their cue from the scattered veils of bluebell that never fail to stir my imagination. The bluebells seem to be in far greater presence along the canal this year. Possibly the tree and undergrowth thinning has helped. And also there's the cerise and pinks and reds that also spangle the fields and towpath edges. And just a short way down the canal, a cluster of pussy willow confetti the air with a spindrift of feathered down. And almost overnight, the yellow flag is out. They roar and blaze along the canal side with their exotic lion-head trumpets. I'm amazed still by how quick things change. One night, a proud green thrust of tall blade-like leaves, spring green and rich. And then, in the morning, from seemingly out of nowhere, the yellow iris opens its throat to drink in the dawn. Suddenness seems to be the character of this spring. From one day to another, overnight, things change. When we got back from Norfolk last weekend, the banks and nearby fields were filled with dandelions, and I'd planned on picking a bundle of heads as I wanted to make some balm. However, it's a busy time at work for me, so I had to put it off. And I also needed the flower heads to be as sun-dried as possible. However, in the space of a day, the field of yellow suns had transformed into a century rose of perfect feathery globes, and the day after that, even they had gone. And only the buttercups and the faintly alien forms of chickweed remain. I'm going to have to wait till the next crop grows or find another field. But from the last few days, a visitor could well be forgiven for thinking that summer had come. But it's not here yet. If you look to the field edges and corners, you'll find that they're still dew wet, even at sundown. During the broad heat of the day, the long grasses remain cool. Buttercups, nettle, thistle, dandelion, and cow parsley grow thick and strong. Here is the place where tufts of plantain and timothy grow tall. The fields smell of baked earth and hay, but here, where the sun's strength still cannot penetrate, it smells gloriously and luxuriously of the nighttime. But despite the sun's strength, it's still not quite at its height. There are corners where the last shadows of winter still cling, and is welcomed by the snail and slugs and all things that delight in the damp and cool. On our midday walks in the heat of the day, I cling to these deep green oases nestled under trees and alongside the hedges. Local ecospheres that remind us once more of how precious trees and their shades are. Maggie snuffles the long grass, dew purling on the short fur around her snout, and I enjoy the feel of damp seeping through my shoes and socks. We're both happy. It's spring in her fullest of strides. Heat ripples over the fields and promises a summer ahead. And here is a verdant green, full and fertile, buzzing with life at the edges, on the margins that are not in fact margins, but the center of everything. If you contacted me over the last week or so, thank you so much. It's always lovely to hear from you. And so thank you to Ruthie, and I love the video, thank you. And Mary Keane, thank you for getting in touch, and it's always lovely to hear from you. And Tony Rutherford, I'm so sorry to hear about your recent setback, and I hope that you're well on your way to full recovery. Please look after yourself, Tony. And a big hello to Captain Arlo. It's great to hear from you. And thank you for the photographs. And also to Barry in the Fens. Again, lovely to hear from you. And thank you also for your comments to Karen Smith and to LJ and Bodie and Mark Stowe and Tracy Thomas, Hannon Cohen, Anna McKellar, Kaz Sargent, Adele, Gillian Sowery, Jan Baxter, Roaming Liz and Jason Polite. More from Jason and Karen in a minute. And of course, thank you to all of our Lockwheelers. They are Chris and Alan on the narrow boat, the land of green ginger. Captain Arlo, Rebecca Russell, Alison on the narrow boat Mucker, Derek and Pauline Watts, Anna V, Orange Cookie, Donna Kelly, Mary Keane, Tony Rutherford, Arabella Holtzapfel, Rory with MJ and Kayla, Narrowboat Precious Jet, Steve, Precious Jet's looking lovely at the moment, Linda Reynolds-Birkins, Richard Noble, Carol Ferguson, Tracy Thomas, Mark and Tricia Stowe, and Madeline Smith. Thank you. In the last episode, I mentioned how much I've been enjoying Karen and Jason Polite's posts of their time on the Leeds and Liverpool Canal. Karen and Jason have been listeners to the podcast for a number of years now and have mentioned to me about their desire to move to the UK to buy a narrowboat and become continuous cruisers. A couple of weeks ago, they flew over from their home in Arkansas to hire a narrowboat and have their first taste of life aboard the canals and waterways of Britain. And the weather seemed, on the main, to be quite kind to them, and they seemed to have a great time. And so I asked Jason if he minded just jotting down a few notes of their first impressions and how the reality measured up to the dream. As I'm sure you'd find it interesting, and I find accounts like this fascinating because the things that I now begin to take for granted are brought once more anew to me. And Jason very kindly sent me this email. And he starts by saying, "We can both say quite easily that living on a narrowboat for a few days did indeed meet all our expectations of how we thought it would be, and that we loved our time on Sam's Drum. It really helped give us an idea of what the life was all about and also allowed us to solidify a few ideas about what we'd look for in a boat for ourselves." And that's such a good point. If you're considering living on a boat or even just buying one and you haven't had any previous experience being on a narrowboat or being on a canal even, this is much the best way to start. And I'd recommend it to everyone. Because living aboard, particularly continuous cruising, is not the type of life for everyone. And there's nothing like first-hand experience. I heard of a couple recently who actually have led pretty well all their married lives a very nomadic lifestyle and who were seriously considering becoming continuous cruisers as the next phase or next step in their life together. And on paper, they looked an absolutely ideal match for this type of life. They were used to living off-grid, they were highly practical, they both had an extremely positive can-do attitude to life and everything that it throws to them. However, after spending a week or two on a hire boat, they both began to feel too hedged in, too restricted to this thin, watery road. They love the mountains and the wilderness areas and places that canals don't really take you to. And as much as they enjoyed the time, they began to realize that actually this type of life just wasn't for them at this moment. It was too claustrophobic, too hemmed in for them. Hiring a boat can help you get a much more realistic picture of not just living on a boat, but the canals themselves. They're not always those remote places of living in the natural world, miles away from everything. And sometimes life at 3 miles an hour with erratic internet access might sound like Haven, but it can in reality be just a little bit too slow for some. And I know it's not always possible, especially if, like Karen and Jason, you live abroad, and it's also costly, but if you can book a week or two in the winter season or early spring, that can also be helpful in experiencing boating when weather feels as if it's against you. But as I say, that's not always feasible. And Jason continues, one of the things that really surprised both of us was how separate the canals are from the cities and towns they go through. I equated it to Karen as similar to how the wizarding world in the Harry Potter books, movies, exists alongside and within the Muggle world, but separate and almost totally unseen. Driving through English cities, you'd never know that canals were there unless you were looking for them. On our last evening aboard, we walked into Silsden, which was super busy and frenetic. But after a couple of minutes of reaching the towpath and walking back toward the boat, you would never have known all that craziness was back there. It was just a wonderfully quiet and peaceful walk back. Yeah, I love your description of it, Jason. Canals can feel exactly like that, like an alley or side street that's missed by the passage of time, where time has slowed down or even stood still. Of course, there are times when the two sit together not quite so easily or comfortably as that. But for the main part, certainly in my experience, yeah, that is absolutely right. And more recently, in some towns and cities, the canals have seen a lot of investment being put into them, turning them into features and gathering places, populated with eateries and coffee shops and leisure retail shops and stuff. And this has also helped transforming what were often derelict and antisocial places into focal points for both residents and boaters. And of course, there are still those places where you wouldn't want to moor. And there are places that are known as trouble spots. But that's where the boater's grapevine can be really helpful in helping to navigate or negotiate your way around them. If you're on a boat, you will quickly hear about the trouble spots. However, again, these are rare. And as often happens, one poor person's bad experience can overshadow 50 who go through that same place and experience no problems at all. So try not to let the horror stories put you off too much. Just keep your eyes and your ears open as you would in any place. And in all my experiences so far, they've always been really positive. And there's that lovely sense of occasion when the two worlds meet, urban and canal. Is exactly as you say, existing alongside and yet somehow remaining separate. Beautifully put. Jason's email continues. So, on to boat life. We absolutely love both it and the lifestyle. It's amazing how easy it was to just hop on and start going without any real previous experience. Driving the boat was fairly intuitive, but it did take a little bit of practice to get the feel of how to get the boat slowed down properly at the bank to get moored or drop Karen off to work the swing bridges we went through. That's a really interesting point, Jason, because I know it is one thing that some people do worry about. And you're right, handling a boat is very intuitive. It's just when you try and stop and think about it, that's when things either get confused or go wrong. Getting the hang of which way to move the tiller is the thing that can catch most people out. You move it in the opposite direction to the way you want the bow, the front of the boat, to turn. And it's perfectly obvious if you don't think about it too much. But when you do try to overthink it, that's when it can become confusing and you end up steering straight into the bank or to a bridge hole. And you're a real rotter making poor Karen do all the swing bridges, although more on them a little later on. And you did say that Karen was a bit surprised at how boaty and floaty the boat felt, and that it wasn't something that she disliked per se, but it was just surprising to her, and that you don't truly get the feel of how much the boat can move around when moored through watching YouTube videos. Actually, that comment surprised me too, as it's never really been something that I've been aware of since moving on to the Erica. I do remember coming back, however, from one of the trips with Mum and Dad, and it feeling a bit odd to walk on solid ground. Everything felt a little bit unyielding and immovable and solid. And I was waiting for it to hit me when we first moved abroad here. You do get the sensation of a gentle rocking from time to time, but not a great deal. And I wonder if it's something about the length of the boat having something to do with it. The boat Mum and Dad hired was, I think, a 48-foot, so a bit shorter than the Erica. And of course, in a lock or when it's really windy and with people getting on and off, you do get that feeling. But as you say, Jason, it's more of a feeling of being afloat than, you know, that sort of quite severe rocking of a boat at sea. And Jason continues, I don't know if this is normal or if our Webasto diesel central heating system was just old and noisy, but it was way too loud to be able to sleep when it was turned on. At times it reminded me of the noise the USS Enterprise made in Star Trek when Scotty was giving it all she's got. We had to resort to switching it off before going to sleep, but even with the temperature dropping below freezing for a couple of nights, it never got uncomfortably cold. A bit chilly perhaps, but not too bad. It worked great at keeping the boat warm, but just too much noise to have on at night. I would imagine that a multi-fuel stove would be a much quieter option for keeping the boat toasty during the night. Am I right in thinking that keeping the boat warmer inside would also keep so much condensation from forming on the insides of the windows? As you say, Jason, it could have just been an old heating system that you had. But I also suspect that it might be the difference between being on a hire boat and one that's been fitted out for actually living on full time. And also, some heaters can be a lot louder than others. There's one near here that I can hear almost a quarter of a mile away in the mornings. However, it can also be down to soundproofing. For example, ours is located in the engine bay, which has some, albeit rudimentary, soundproofing, but is also fitted within its own box that, again, has been soundproofed. It is noisy. The first winter, it did used to wake me up, but then so did the boiler in the house that we had rented before that. And I don't really notice it now, or I'm only subconsciously aware of it. However, unless it's really cold and there is a danger of pipes freezing, we and most boaters tend to just use them for the evening and the morning rather than running them all the way through the night. And yeah, a multi-fuel stove is much quieter. And we also find that it has a, if this makes any sense, a friendlier warmth. It has a more sort of encompassing, embracing, drier warmth than we get from the radiators. But your point about condensation, yeah, condensation can be a real problem on a boat. Double glazing can help a lot, although most boats aren't fitted with it. Some people, however, do retrofit it and say that the difference is amazing. Also, I've found that some boats are more prone to condensation than to others. We have a bit, but certainly there's a boat that one winter that was fairly close to us that just seemed to be continuously dripping with condensation. And that might be that they were having problems with either leaks or water in their bilge or something. However, some condensation on cold nights is pretty much inevitable, and having a warm boat won't necessarily stop the condensation. In fact, it won't stop the condensation, but what it does do is that it creates a much warmer drier environment, so it doesn't feel quite so clammy and cold as it would if you were keeping the cabin a lot cooler. But again, it might be also indicative of a hire boat that's not necessarily fitted out for colder weather versus, again, a boat that has been specifically fitted out for all year long living and therefore has more or better quality insulation. There are different types of material used for insulation, and it's always good when you are in the position of looking to buy a boat to ask what insulation it does have, because as you've seen, it does make a difference. The pump-out toilet on the boat may have also changed our minds about whether we would want to go with a pump-out or not. It was a very finickety thing that really didn't do the best job of getting rid of solid waste. It would take a few tries sometimes and seem to be a bit wasteful when it came to water. Of course, we know nothing of how or how well cassette toilets work or whether there are better pump-out systems out there, so we're on the fence regarding what toilet system we would prefer now. That's interesting, because I know that pump-outs were a question that you posed for an earlier episode, and I'm sorry that you found it not terribly effective. And although I'm not a particular fan of them, most people who do have them don't seem to have any real problems with them. The problems are when they're not working, when they don't work, they're a pain. So it might just have been unfortunate that you had one that didn't work terribly well. And it's true that you don't get those problems with cassettes because they are much, much simpler. But you do, on the downside, have to change and empty them a lot sooner. So you're constantly doing that and have in the back of your mind that, oh, do I need to change the cassette? Jason then goes on to write, I found it quite interesting how busy the towpaths were with walkers and ramblers near Bradley. But everyone was super nice, saying hello and asking how we were. There was a real sense of community in that regard that was quite nice to experience. There was also the case for passing boaters who would always wave with a quick hello or passing chat. Yeah, I know, it's lovely, isn't it? The towpaths around here have been so incredibly busy recently, and at times almost just one long crocodile line. But as you say, the friendliness and the interest is always really lovely. And the more you spend time on the water, particularly if you do become continuous cruisers, you will really get to experience that sense of community and support with other boaters. And although I know that year on year I hear complaints by older, long-standing boaters that it isn't like it used to be, it is still there, and I think it's one of the real bonuses of canal life. Jason had mentioned the swing bridges or dropping Karen off to the swing bridges earlier on. And then he goes on to say, Karen found the physical exertion required for working some of the rural farm swing bridges to be a bit daunting. There was at least one where it took both of us to get it moving. We understand those rural swing bridges won't be maintained as well as the city bridges, but the fact that they're not also makes us wonder about the future of other areas of canal maintenance with the CRT budget cuts that have been put in place. That's something we'll be keeping an eye on in the next couple of years while continuing to get enough money saved up for me to emigrate on a spousal visa with Karen. Oh, swing bridges. Now, they can be a real pain. I mean, literally. And I know both of you wanted to experience some locks, but weren't able to because of the stretch of the canal that you were on. But don't worry, locks are not as hard work as most hand-operated swing bridges are. Yes, there is an element of lack of maintenance about it, but I think it's also down to some of their designs. There are some great ones, like those that you can pull down with a rope on the Oxford Canal, but there are some of those ratchet-operated ones around here that are almost impossible to do. And when you have succeeded, it feels like you've been in a gym for the last 3 hours. So please don't let that put you off. But you are making a very good and important point with the budget cuts and questions of maintenance, which I think is a high concern for most of us who are living on the canals. And Jason concludes his email with, "Overall, we were really happy with how well we got on with living on the boat and didn't have any great hardships or adjustments to make. It was all just really normal, no different than a house really, as far as basic living with cooking, showering, using a hairdryer, refrigerator, etc. And the only difference there was just being in a smaller space, so a couple has to really like being around one another, which is no problem for us, thankfully. There were a few things I was worried about that ended up being no problem whatsoever. I was really worried about smells or odours from stagnant water and or diesel fuel or exhaust, and none of that was an issue, nor were there any problems more than so than a house with insects and spiders in the boat. So that was really great, and those worries were alleviated. So yeah, it was a wonderful experience and one we definitely needed to get under our belts before considering making these huge life changes. As of now, I believe the plan is for us to continue working toward that goal and hope that everything works out financially for us to be able to move in the direction of pursuing it." Well, I'm really glad, Jason, that you and Karen had a great time and that it did meet your expectations and actually helped to allay some of those fears and concerns and worries. And I do really hope that everything works out and that you will be able to one day come over and live life here on the canals. And thank you so much, Jason, for such an informative and fascinating email. Thank you. This is the Narrowboat Erica, signing off for the night and wishing you a very restful and peaceful night. Good night. Temperature outside 15.6 degrees. Inside 21 degrees. Humidity 67%. Dew point 11 degrees. Wind direction east. Wind strength 7 miles per hour. Barometric pressure 1018.3 falling. Cloud cover 18%. Cloud ceiling none. Precipitation nil. Moon phase 16.8%, waxing crescent. Day length 15 hours 32 minutes. Sunset 20:50. Sky casting 5:16.